Talking with Greg Moynihan, Henry's father, from Massachusetts, and incidentally, a professor of history at Bard College. Mm-hmm. And we'll be having a little conversation about the end of the world, because according to the Mayan calendar, the end of the world is coming this December, December 21st. You want to mark your calendar and get rid of everything after December 21st. Maybe celebrate Christmas early this year. I had the date wrong. I thought it was May. So my apologies. I won't be doing the show live today. I had already made prior arrangements. What's the value of studying history? I know this is kind of out of left field, but in terms of understanding human patterns, and why do people want an end to history?
I guess in the first question, why study history? For this case, it's particularly interesting, since it's a good example where, in fact, knowing that there have been previous predictions of the end of the world makes a big difference about how you feel about the end of the world, and knowing how people reacted to them makes a big difference for the end of the world. So, if for no other reason, history is useful for studying that, you know, how people thought of other major time cessations and breaks. The value of studying history in light of this question? I mean, I think actually, I mean, as I understood it, the Mayans were saying less that the world was going to definitively end than that there's a massive transition in what the world is, which might seem like the world's ending. But in that case, it seems like studying history is handy because it's basically a study of learning to try to figure out what the lay of the land is in terms of power and possibility of changes, possibility of strange inversions of things or transformations that you wouldn't be able to see in the present. And I think in that regard, the Mayan calendar concept is sort of a useful one. You know, even if the world doesn't end in December, it's sort of a nice idea to think there might be some fundamental structural transformation happening. Or
it happens every morning at like 6 o'clock.
So I think that's a big part of it. So I'd say, you know, right there you have two big pluses for history. One, it's not just antiquarian. You don't necessarily care about what happened in the past just because it's the past. You care about it because how people thought of reality and what possibilities for change were hidden for them that we now can see, that you might not otherwise be able to see, or at least be able to believe such a change is possible. You know, when you look back at the Roman Empire and, you know, this entire structure of power that seemed so complete and seemed to know everything, and, you know, you realize the obvious things of them not really having access to the number zero or what that would mean, not really having a, you know, functional version of math because of that. You know, that there are, from our perspective, huge gaps, and probably there are huge gaps like that in our civilization and our thoughts too. And so I think it's the possibility of recognizing that, even if you don't know what those are going to be. And then it's also the possibility of seeing that people have thought there would be an end to history, or that they thought there would be an obvious something in their world that didn't turn out to be that way, is itself sort of useful. And then just, you know, the mere fact of trying to do some justice to what people, different people's lives looked like, in a way that is obscured.
What do you mean by justice?
I think in the literal sense of justice, you know, sort of giving nobody up for loss, like actually trying to care what it was like to be a peasant in the 9th century, or trying to think through what it was like to be, you know, a maid in some obscure Roman outpost in the British Isles in the 7th century or something, you know, and actually trying to think through that and think through what it was to be a human being then is also part of the project.
You think it was fundamentally different?
Yes. I mean, I think it's, there are different ways of approaching history, and I think some people would try to say that there's just general human continuities. I'd say particularly political scientists and the way they look at history would tend to try to find out what the big generalities are, right? How do people deal with power? Is there really any difference between Thucydides and the way we think of power now? Maybe human behavior is mainly the same. I think that's one way you could approach it. I have almost the exact opposite view, which is I think it's always the first rule of history to me is to assume that things were drastically different in the past.
History is a foreign country. People do things differently over there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just the notion that even when it looks similar, they might be doing things in a very different way. And I think in a manner that's more evident now than it would have been even 40 years ago, because I think we can see how there's been huge transformations and even relatively obvious phenomena. You know, I would say New York City, we're 90 miles north of New York City, I would say New York City means and is something radically different now than it was 30 years ago, because it used to be you had no way of seeing foreign or experimental film. You had no access to used books. You had...
You mean up here?
Up here, not up here altogether, but it was just much harder. You really had to live in the city, and that meant that there was a collection of people, as there still are.
And yet people, friends who live in the city, still call ahead when they come up and ask if they could bring you anything, like bagels.
Right.
Which I find cute once I get past my rage
right.
at their condescension.
Although in some cases they might be right about a few particular items.
You could get,
do
you
the
could
morning
get pretty
of.
Good bagel in Kingston.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's the case. I think something like a book, right? I mean, you think of what it would be like to have access to any book in 15th century Spain, and just what a tremendous privilege that would be, and how you would read that book, and how that would be a precious item to even be able to read once, you know, in some monastery's library or something.
Well, they're doing that in the high schools now.
They're limiting the
number of books that students can have. I don't think that that's their intention, is to make them seem more precious. But
it might be an unintentional.
I think my next class I will introduce and say I only have 3 books.
Yeah, I think that it could work. There could be a way it becomes precious. But I think both printing as a revolution and then the paperback revolution in the 50s and 60s both made it so that people think it's a totally common thing to have, you know, Cervantes, and that to buy that for $1.50 at a used bookstore, which I think is a fabulous possibility, but I think it changes the way we deal with the text in a pretty basic way. And I think once you see that those sorts of changes have happened, even within, you know, your parents' lifetime, mm-hmm. in a fairly drastic mm-hmm. way, then you can appreciate how much things might have changed also over longer periods of time, and how much they might be different in the future. So as much as the, you know, dismaying state of the world at any given point seems hopeless, how much there is a possibility for real transformation, and hence how much there might be to the end of the world that might present new possibilities.
There was an article or interview I heard recently with Carl Bernstein, and mm-hmm. he was giving a lecture or something at Harvard, and he was asked, you know, the students were asked, how would the internet have affected the Watergate investigations, at the time, and the students said it would have been much simpler. You could have just looked up stuff online, and Bernstein was horrified that this is not like a 2-year college. This is Harvard, and they did not understand that people had to go talk to people and write these things and put them up there, that this entire universe that we rely on now, which is amazing, is the product of physical, actual people doing actual investigative work.
Yeah, and more to
the... And it is devalued just by the pure quantity of it that's available.
No, I think that's true. I think a lot of students now have trouble even knowing how to look up anything that doesn't involve entering something into a search entry point, you know, that just using a more complex reference tool is difficult. But I think the bigger issue for what Bernstein was saying is that the main delusion that the internet has led to is the notion that you can find things on the internet, when in fact most of the valuable databases in history and most other fields are not immediately accessible through Google. Secondly, there's a lot of ways you need to be able to use even a tool like Google to be able to really get access to information you want and to sift through things. And you know, I think that students minimally have to spend a week using something like a Google reference book to be able to figure out how you can limit things by date or by type of website, by access, how you know, just even the basic rules for how to do that. The idea that you just type something in and get what you want is not accurate to begin with. And then, of course, the main thing is that there's a huge amount of information that was not digitized and is not in an apparent friendly form. And something like the Watergate investigations exactly contain that sort of information. Mm. It would never have been on Google in the first place. If anything, I think ever more, search and the use of Google is concealing information. And that there's a huge amount of material that people can just make invisible because of the assumption that you're seeing it in the first place. Mm. And I think there's also a huge amount of material that is easily concealed if you don't digitize it. And, or if you put it anywhere behind a firewall, you know, think of everything from law, memos in corporations, all that stuff that for a while people mistakenly were doing on email, you can easily in different ways conceal. And then a lot of the history of how something came about is not present anymore. Right. Whereas it used to be assumed everything was on paper, and that if you wanted to get access to it, it might take decades, it might take a long time, but that's how you're going to do it. Once people start to assume that's not the case anymore, I think there's actually a greater chance of losing information.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it sort of every great change in society? You know, you could call it a, you know, an end point, and you know, before the next technology or before the next structure is fully in place, things are lost. I mean, things were lost from the old analog audio storage system. You know, there's stuff on vinyl that you can't get on CD.
CD and DVD are a terrible medium for permanence. So
those are rather short lived comparatively, and now everything is, you know, MP3s or
right.
Things are not being sort of transferred.
Yeah,
to
which
those
I mean,
as well.
So. And there's a whole story, as I'm sure you're aware of. MP3 itself was never meant to be a high density audio recording medium, and that became a standard is sort of a catastrophe for audio quality.
Is that
audio.
Right?
Yeah, it was originally there's a whole sort of mini history of it, but it was intended for high compression and for economy, basically, and it does what it does well. But both for that and for CDs, there's a whole sort of set of compromises that engineers made that they didn't necessarily intend to have become an industry standard or intend to have be the way that things are recorded for posterity, because they knew it involved a loss of information. So in a way there, too, you could say that actually a lot of digitization is a continuous loss filter,
because most people assume that it's just a continual progression towards better and better and better.
No, I mean, look at what's happened with cell phones. That's the living embodiment that we've all seen.
Is that right?
It used to be a regular phone call. Actually, it was extremely good audio quality. But cell phones are mainly based on access. People want the coverage and basically transmission of a certain amount of information in a vocal conversation. And the algorithms and the means by which cell phones communicate are considerably worse now than they were 5 years ago.
Why I still got my old flip phone.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, you would think they're getting better, but in fact, they're getting more coverage, and you're getting more information, and it's getting more economical. But the audio quality is much worse than it is in a landline, or was in a landline in the analog days.
There are parallels, if I may bring this back to foraging, and history and the end of the world, between food.
Mm-hmm.
What we are accustomed to putting in our mouths, tomatoes, fresh vegetables, meat, it tastes completely different than it did 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, the diversity of food that people eat. Now, any individual probably would have a pretty mundane diet. I mean, most people generally eat the same thing most days, seasonally, you know, not get the best nutrition in the winter, but there was so much more variety of squashes and beans and...
Yeah, if you were in the right place at the right time, you know, if you were, say, in this area in the Revolutionary War, and it was July or August, I think you were eating considerably better, is my sense.
Oh, yeah.
That said, I mean, there is a lot of evidence that as much as the sort of industrialization of agriculture in the last 40 years has been a particular disaster and the sort of limitation of crops.
But in terms of flavor, I'm just talking about flavor.
Right, flavor.
You know, I'm not talking.
So I was going to say, in terms of actual
the economics
access to nutrition,
of it,
it's gotten a lot better.
There's no argument there. Mm-hmm. But in terms of flavor, like...
Right.
I mean, there are people who are our age who have never actually tasted what a real strawberry. That strawberries, you need to... you know, douse in sugar because they're so bitter and tart.
Yeah.
You know, these gigantic things in the supermarket that are bright red and, you know. But people who grow strawberries, or if you get some fresh local strawberries when they're in season, It's like they're like a completely different animal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we have just grown accustomed to gradually, you know, a sacrifice like in technology,
mm-hmm.
For a breadth,
yeah.
coverage, data, over quality.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the argument of a lot of the locavores, and I don't know the details of it, is that it's also a quality of nutrition, and, you know, eggs being a good example, mm-hmm. where there's actually a substantial decline in the quality of the food in terms of not just taste, but how good it is for you and what it's doing.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that seems pretty evident as well. And I think there is a sort of sweet spot that would be difficult, so to speak. That would be difficult to hit again, but, you know, where you had the diversity. And you also had distribution, you know, maybe in the 1920s in this area where we had local crops going to New York City and mm-hmm. we had train lines that allowed that to happen without having just produce trucks driving in.
Right, right.
And you also had local farms that were in this area, you know, and that did a lot. And at the same time, you know, as much as I'm a sort of fan of the locavore movement, it is important to note just how much we take good nutrition and a, you know, what looks like a normal supermarket to us
mm-hmm.
for granted, when that's just a huge difference. And there's a lot of studies looking at human nutrition over the last 150 years, even people's stature and how they're growing,
mm-hmm.
that shows, you know, the average person in the 1860s or 1870s was not necessarily getting a particularly good diet, you know, particularly if you were in a city.
No, but they were walking a lot.
They were walking a lot. Yeah, your average person on a farm would be a totally different story, but a lot of people in different areas and famines and that sort of thing aside elsewhere in the world.
Mm.
In any case, I think that, you know, those big structures sort of lead us to be able to see that even though there's technological progress, it's not necessarily progress in terms of the particulars of what quality is or how things are changing.
Mm.
And in that way, the sort of end of the world always has a quality of either being the end of a long decline or the end of a long progression. And I think we're in a sort of complex state where it's both happening at once to some extent.
Really? You know, that we're in the middle of a
I think just a lot of some things are getting much better and some things are getting much worse, and they're both happening so fast it's hard to know quite what the, you know, gyration will be, you
and
know,
do you think that's
come
the
December
appeal?
2012.
Do you think historically that's the appeal, that the confusion, the complexity, the almost impossibility of understanding the world makes some people just yearn for just a clean break?
Yeah, I think so. I think also that there's...
It's like starting, let's just start over.
Yeah.
You know,
I think also there's a general issue of rate of change where it does seem to be, you know, whether you believe in the details or not, that, and, you know, whether it's Moore's Law or Ray Kurzweil's
What's Moore's Law for...
just, you know, the idea of an exponential increase in computer memory or computer speed, and then Kurzweil and his team have sort of generalize that to say there's a general exponential increase in the speed of change of technology more generally. You know, everything from mapping and reproducing DNA to any number of factors. And all of that could lead to really fabulously good things, but it also immediately leads to potential for huge disaster.
Yeah.
And certainly the coordination of the different elements of technology seems really tricky to figure out. So
yeah.
I think in that way, the end of the world scenario sort of makes sense to a lot of people. You know, they sort of feel like, well, you know, global climate change or other things, once they've decided that those are really happening, they don't know quite how you would manage to make sense of them and what that would mean for your life, or, you know, in my case, for my son's life, for instance.
Right.
And therefore, the notion of an end of the world seems
teach
at least
them how to swim,
concentrate, concentrate the mind, you know, and in a way, and also concentrate the mind on the fact that there are a lot of very positive changes happening with the very negative changes. You know, I think even something like the internet, when you think of, you know, the internet as a platform, you know, the structural possibilities that raises for doing very human things, you know, learning new dance moves, or, you know, learning how to play that guitar part, hearing what somebody in China has to say, you know, a lot of that is really on a humane level deeply powerful and important, even as it's leading to new possibilities of surveillance, new possibilities of breakdown if things go wrong.
I mean, the Arab Spring, most people seem to think really made possible by the internet, by Facebook.
Yeah. And it's clear that partly because of that, a lot of governments have figured out how to use it in the opposite direction too.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know how that's going to play out exactly. But I think, you know, the particular interest in this end of the world compared to the hundreds and hundreds before is the possibility of it as some sort of inflection point, something where things could change really quickly, and also an awareness that things could change really quickly, that it wouldn't take much to cause some sort of global disruption or some major transformation. on one level or the other.
I always liked what you said about the demise of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. That in 1914, you know, there was like a major player in European politics and on the world stage, and in 1918 they were a rump state with Sarajevo.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, or a few, you know, I think I was talking about particularly Austria. Like from the point of view of Vienna,
yeah,
you know, as Freud said, it was like, you know, living in the torso of this previous body, you know, because suddenly you had lost everything that defined who you were in the first place. And particularly for the country that became Austria, you know, the area that was more or less sort of hegemonically in control of at least half the empire, I think that was a huge shock, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the sort of transition that you can imagine. I think also the transition from an empire to a state, and just mm-hmm. what that would mean and how we would think of that.
Do you think the United States is in that transition?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think in any obvious way. Of all the various transitions, I think the state system is here to stay for a while because of things like armies and police, and the U.S. in particular is a pretty strong example of that. I think the difference is changes coming, you know, within and without the state, in a way, you know, the development of, you know, on one hand, international corporations and their obvious long-term development of power over the last 50 years, but also NGOs, international law, a lot of things that are less obvious but are starting to sort of transform the state. You know, Europe at the moment is not looking like a particularly positive example, but you know, the European Union was a really interesting transformation of state sovereignty.
Mm.
And I think there were certain advantages that were found in that that could happen again. But I think in my sense is that the United States is, despite all of its problems, a pretty stable example, particularly in a way the more we return to our ideals, the more durable it is. You know, I think in a way, you know, Hart and Negri in their book Empire, you know, it was written in around 2000, you know, make it sound as if in a way the U.S. became so durable because we provided a world model of a set of ideals. And that's sort of ironic since, you know, the reaction to 9/11 and 2001 in some ways caused us to compromise those in a way that they would say is exactly diminishing our world power.
Mm.
But I think to the degree we return to those ideals,
so
the U.S. appeals to a lot of people. I mean, it's still the main country of immigration.
World power, seem to be defining world power not so much as in sort of military or even economic prowess, but rather as moral and ethical.
That's a combination. I mean, the political scientists always describe it as soft and hard power, which I don't think is the best combination. But I think the U.S. as a nation state draws a tremendous amount of its power from the appeal for immigration, the appeal as a set of ideals for people around the world, and the sort of promise of a better life. And I was just about to say, and that's part of why it remains, even among its critics, one of the prime destinations for immigration. You know, in the Middle East or in other places, in general, people will say a lot of bad things about the U.S., but when it comes to where they might want to have their kids go,
right,
it's a place they believe in to some extent, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think, you know, the European Union provided some interesting examples of providing more strict ideals in some ways, say in terms of environmental protections,
right,
or protections, right, of individual data and privacy, that I think potentially could do a similar thing, you know, sort of make that a place where it's like, oh, I'd like to set my business up there because there I know that I'm safe from being spied on, or there I know that, you know, the goods that I'm getting for my kids are not just being sold because somebody gave a politician money so that they look to the side for regulations. And I think that kind of power is very real. And I think in the United States, in some ways, was by far the best example of that for a certain amount of time. And I don't see too many other places that would take the place of that. You know, China or Russia
China does not have an immigration issue.
No. And, you know, and I think the problem that they're trying to reckon with is that it still has a lot of internal, you know, graft and bureaucracy and scale that
mm-hmm.
they're well aware of, but that's not catching up with the economic and military mm-hmm. aspect. You know, it's a country run in large part by some very smart technocrats, and they realize that they need to complete a process of sort of modernization and of increased flexibility in their own system. I mean, you can see that with something like environmental reforms, where in many cases the Central Party encouraged rural peasants to note and protest against party leaders who were breaking environmental laws, because that was a way for them to find people who were not obeying the rules and also to sort of modernize from the ground up. So it wasn't necessarily as if the environment was their sole concern, but they realized they could use the environment as a means of sort of overseeing different aspects of the party. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of ways in which China, I think global climate change is actually the most obvious one. China will be able to present itself in 10 years as a leader in terms of a number of different cultural and intellectual areas, where they'll say, you know, we actually, they could potentially say if they decided to, you know, we actually recognize global climate change. We've tried these forms of transforming our economy. And the U.S., for political reasons, will not look good in that regard, right? And it will look like our system wasn't able to respond.
Yeah.
Not purely political, but largely political. Our system wasn't able to respond, or interests were able to block that in a way that didn't happen in China. And I think that kind of thing works very well for the sort of global brand of a country or a region. And I think China will be able to say, we're a country of scientists and technocrats and people who get things done, in a way that the U.S. would need to counter in some way. But all that said, to come back to your question, I think the U.S., exactly because of the interesting way it was founded and the ideals, is a very durable nation state. I mean, even aside from, you know, massive economic and military cultural power that we now have, you know, I think a lot of that will undoubtedly fade. That's going to happen. I mean, it was the French for a while called us the hyperpower. That was the phrase that was used.
Hyperpower.
A country that not only was a superpower, but basically had world dominance in sort of all five fields. It was the French foreign minister said this at once. You know, of economics, cultural, military, you know, in each field, the U.S. As of 2000, really sort of...
With a massive... With a massive insecurity complex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, as a hyperpower, you have to have an insecurity power...
Or
complex, because you're only going to go down to some extent, right? I mean, the question is...
I always felt like... Having lived in Ireland and you having married a Canadian, it's really valuable to see a country and a people who have never and will never hear the phrase, we're number one, right? And I think the United States, we're just going to have to get used to, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you're not a good person or a country if you're not number one, as long as you try your best.
You've been teaching.
There are so many other things that make life interesting than, like, global domination.
Yeah. Well, and also that, you know, I think a country like England is a good example where, even though there are some rough patches in there, there's something to be said for sort of managing decline in a way that works for you and
they
that allows
manage
you to
decline very well. I mean,
and that allows you to sort of partner with other people, in their case the U.S., you know, in order to create both a stable world and a world in which new and interesting things can happen based on a slightly different model than the one you had. And I think, you know, the U.S. and Europe or China could be in a similar situation. But in any case, nobody's going to remain a hyperpower for very long. And you're, you know, if you're going to manage that...
But is there a danger... for a country like the United States that defines itself, you know, I mean, for a generation, we essentially defined ourselves against the Soviet Union.
Right.
And we went through, as far as I could tell, a serious identity crisis.
Yeah.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, God forbid I say this, but, like, Islamic fundamentalism was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
In that we could now redefine ourselves in opposition to something.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think the U.S. has had a long history of sort of oppositional thinking in which we sort of define our positive aspects of ourselves.
It's much easier to clarify your own position when somebody is diametrically opposed.
Right.
That's not just the United States, but it's, you know, it's individuals. It's, you know, it helps you, like you said, thinking about the end of the world, helps sharpen and focus your thinking.
I mean, I think that for the U.S., the standard opposite position is not to say that we're no longer number one, but basically to retreat back into our borders. You know, I think that a strange thing that's happened since World War II is that we became, you know, a global power and then potentially the global power with, you know, 500 military bases around the world, and just that's how we defined ourselves. But, you know, before 1939, 38 or 39, we essentially always defined or had long defined ourselves as being an island and sort of exceptional precisely in our non-involvement.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is our other likely default position mm-hmm. in some way. I think we still always have our enemies and we always have... But I think what was new about the Cold War is this notion that we were meant to be a global player in some sort of way. And I think that was, you know, important. I think the sort of retreat from the world stage has as many dangers as the expansion into it in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. Certainly the U.S. has never been in the position of Ireland or other places. We just consider yourself a sort of secondary power to begin with.
Mm-hmm. But now we have good beer.
Now we have good beer. So we have, yeah, something else.
And cultural. You think of a country like Ireland or even or Canada. You know, they are cultural dynamos.
Yeah.
And the value that people get for themselves and for their country is through the culture that they produce.
Yeah, and for the Canadians, for the comedy they produce that mainly has to do with being within the U.S. cultural sphere.
Yeah, no, I mean the greatest, some of the greatest comedians of the 20th century are from that country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that isn't the United States.
Yeah. So I think that's true. And I guess in a way, when I think about the end of the world, I don't necessarily think about it with the United States. I think the U.S. has a lot of internal problems. I can see a lot of great things about this country potentially
falling apart. So you don't see the United States falling apart in the next 50 years. You don't see that end that when the end of the empire that there's not going to be an element in this country that is going to just go down kicking and screaming.
I think there could be. I mean, for better or worse, I can see the U.S. becoming, you know, a worse place. You know, I can see it becoming, you know, sort of going in the direction of Latin American democracies from the 19th into the 20th century, where, you know, in the name of civilization and Christianity, you had a turn towards dictatorship and horrible things. It would be tricky in the U.S. because of the focus on the Constitution. I mean, I think that's one of the advantages we have, is that even people on the right, in general, always defend the Constitution,
yeah.
Whereas in most of the rest of the world, the idea that a piece of paper is going to be how you think about your country doesn't make sense. And
yeah.
I think that gives us
certain
durability.
Well, the older the piece of paper is, the stronger it is.
Yeah,
stronger...
but I guess my point is, say, even if that were to happen, I don't see the U.S. being the first thing to break up. You know, I see it just changing into something that's not as great as it was. But I don't see it being the sort of... I don't see that as being the key issue in some ways. Whereas when I think end of the world, I think of really sort of global structural issues that will... exist before the U.S.
Really? Like what? Like, can you give me an example of a global, like?
Well, I think global climate change, you know, is essentially in the view of any scientific estimation, or I would say 99% of scientific estimations, it's not a question anymore. And you know, the Chinese, Russian, and U.S. militaries have all taken that into account. The CIA
have
reports for a long period of time. This is, you know. You know, something I think when you look at the Nobel Prize that went to the UN committees on climate change, basically what you had there is hundreds and hundreds of different studies of different species, each acting essentially as a thermometer, and each saying that, in fact, climate was, in most cases, warming, but that doesn't necessarily mean always warming, but changing in different areas in ways that will lead to huge problems. And I think there's a very high likelihood. There's a CIA report in 2001, 2002, that I believe that they put out, where, you know, they basically said this, you know, for places like Bangladesh or any place near the water, this is going to lead to massive upheaval and problems. And, you know, it might be that we end up with a technical fix for it. I think a lot of the people who are interested in denying the science of it now wouldn't necessarily deny that these changes are happening, but would deny why they're happening. But I think that that's something that's... I'm fine, thanks. That I think that's something that... you know, has the potential to be a global issue and to lead to global food shortages, global changes in climate, global changes in coastlines that would be much more foundational. And I think it's one that's likely to at this point. I mean, I think that, you know, if you look at the Naomi Oreskes book, Merchants of Doubt, which I think is the best thing written on this in the last 5 years, you know, you really can see that basically... this is a phenomena that on the level of science, in the way we normally think of science, is beyond doubt. I would have less idea of somebody pointing a loaded 22 at my head, and if they pulled the trigger, the gun would fire, then I would about this science, basically. I mean, it's that likely. Mm. And, you know, I think that is something that has been successfully obfuscated by public relations, but is not obfuscated, you know.
But to what end?
Why have they done this?
I mean, I think Michael Moore, when he had his television program, mm-hmm. He was amazed that anybody gave him a television program, and he came to the conclusion that, you know, the wonderful thing about capitalism and capitalists is that they will sell you the rope with which you intend to hang them.
Uh-huh. Right, and so you're saying, why would people be concealing this? I think there's two or three reasons. I
understand almost from the psychological point,
right,
that you just don't want to acknowledge that this is happening. Because if it does, that means you have to change the way you live, the way you think, and you're just not interested.
Well, then particularly you'd have
confronting
to
confronting that.
It's particularly something that wouldn't be able to be handled without some sort of large government intervention. So a lot of people who are interested in opposing it see that as the basic problem. And I think the concern for that from a libertarian perspective otherwise makes complete sense. The irony is that the longer we don't deal with it on some level, the more drastic and extreme the government intervention will have to be in order to have it. I mean, basically, once you get to the level of what we're looking at 20 or 30 years down the road, then you're talking really serious sort of martial state controls needed to be able to control people's movements and other things. Whereas what we're looking at now is relatively, not now, but what we would have been looking at 5 years ago is relatively small transformation. So I think when you look at it, and I would say the Oreskes book is a good example of this, you know, the think tanks that were paid for to do this, which were the same think tanks that tobacco had used, same think tanks the ozone people had used, you know, basically a lot of those people really earnestly believe that in general most, you know, that there's a possibility for distortion in science, that this is being misused in the name of government intervention and for particular sort of ideologies. But ultimately, the key thing that they're concerned about is just that this would be a problem that you would have to have some other response to
international. The free market would not be able to address the problems that the free market created.
I think there are people, and certainly, you know, if you look at General Electric or other corporations that well recognize that if you position yourself right, you can make money off each side of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that basically things are going to get so bad, you're going to need some sort of technological fix. And it will have to be on such a massive scale that whoever is ahead of that potentially can make a ton of money. And in that case, I think there's an argument to be made for capitalism resolving this. But to do that, you'd have to recognize the information in the first place. And to come back to my basic point, I'd say a place like China, in 10 years looking back, will be able to say, we were on top of this in a way the United States was not able to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that will look very bad for the United States. And it'll look very bad for the functioning of this country. And they'll be able to say, we're a country of technocrats and scientists who are able to manage these kind of problems. And so in that regard, I would say that's a negative for the United States. But of course, 10 years is not assuming the apocalypse in December of 2012, which I guess is our theme. So, I mean, I would say for the more short term.
Well, no, I think, you know, the world ends every night and it begins every day. And, being with kids, you know, teenagers, you know, most of my day, the world that they know intimately is so foreign to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not foreign to me because I'm not a teenager, because I, you know me, I'm rather childish,
mm-hmm.
But just how they spend their time and how they communicate and what they're interested in is, which just wasn't available to us,
mm-hmm.
as kids.
Right.
And I feel bad for them.
Mm-hmm.
And in their complete lack of coordinated disobedience. I mean, it's always difficult to get teenagers to sort of work together. But if they had a ideal or something to, like, unify them.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any ever sit-ins at your schools or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think in my day the big one was the South African divestment.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, in retrospect, I think was relatively successful. I think
Well, that's another example of a world that ended and not in catastrophe.
Not at all. And I think, you know, if anything, there's been a set of tales to be told about how you manage that kind of transition.
Mm-hmm.
Germany, which I study, is a good example where really ends, you know, in catastrophe in 1945, and with a lot of people complicit in the catastrophe, and the, you know, no obvious way in which this is going to resolve itself. And through basically a sort of drastic policy of trying to become as transparent about things as you could, at least by the mid-60s, you know, sort of setting itself up as a model of how you resolve or get through this sort of problem from the past. You know, I was amazed that the German companies, for instance, gladly pay researchers to dig around in their archives and explicitly say there's no limits on what you can publish. As long as you say, we paid for you to publish it, because what they really want to say is, we're not concealing anything and we got to it first. They want to be able to control the, you know, distribution of
information. You're talking about digging into archives. You're talking
like
digging into the archives from World War II.
Yeah, from World War II or from before, or family
and
archives.
Ugliness.
Yeah, exactly, which is very different than other places where you would say, we want to conceal or hold back on this. They already know everybody's going to be complicit, or a lot of people will be complicit. There'll be bad things. Better that everybody know. And I think, you know, in a smaller example, the various ways in which truth commissions functioned in South Africa or in the Latin American countries, you know, set up an example where people can imagine getting out of a situation that it used to appear like you couldn't get out of, that the people in power will never give up power. If they do give up power, it'll be in such a catastrophic way the country will be finished. And I think that's, you know, there's a model for
That's heartening.
Yeah, I think it is heartening, and I think it's a big improvement in a lot of ways, because I think there's now a possibility for saying, you know, to a dictator, you're better off just leaving, and you know, and you know, signing some agreement like this, and whether that's right or not, I don't know, but it means that there's a possibility for an afterwards, even when this situation appears disastrous, and there's a possibility for development.
It's just kind of like growing up,
you
know. Or being the grown-ups that we all hope will be.
We all hope
our children will eventually become.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a better possibility. No, I think that's true. And I think, I also think even though it's infamously weak, the development of international law has changed the way people perceive of these things. There is a sense that if you commit really heinous crimes, you could well be held accountable for them. And that whole notion just used to not exactly exist. The notion that there are norms internationally, or norms to how you're supposed to treat people, even to the degree that that exists as a limit case or as a possibility, I think is a big improvement. And that's a way of, you know, potentially starting to restructure or reimagine things. So, you know, I think that's an area where there is potential. But yeah, I would say in general, to me, the most worrisome aspect, I mean, global climate change is the principal example of it, but that's just because it sort of snuck up on us. You know, we didn't realize we were having a free lunch ever since, you know, Claremont or the Livingstons got the steam engine going here on the Hudson, or, you know,
right.
It was just like, this is great. You have this faster mode of transportation. You're just burning a little bit of coal, a little bit of wood. Only recently have we recognized the consequences of that, and that's sort of worrisome in the terms of all the other ways technology is changing aspects of the world we don't know about, and the way it can lead to complicated, you know, networks of change and transformation, and that those frequently escape us. And I think, you know, the contemporary worries about the end of the world have to do with that. You know, what would happen if
the armies of darkness and the armies of light meeting in the plains of Megiddo?
Yeah, it's more like the gray goo, you know, meeting with the, you know, I don't know, the supercomputer brain patterns, you know, something like, it's no longer black and white at all, right? I mean,
right.
Gray goo is always this fear of the nanotechnology taking over and somebody just creating something that just reproduces and reproduces and causes this disaster. You can imagine that combined with all manner of other complex technological issues, you know, to present just a worrisome array of possibilities that we just don't know how we'd quite control.
Your favorite end of the world prediction? That
from the past?
Yeah. Well, yes.
Well, I think, I mean, my favorite predictions in general all come from the same person, which is Charles Fourier, the utopianist. And he had a utopian ideal that I always thought sounded like the end of the world, which is that through sort of terraforming, we'd create the oceans into like vast vats of lemonade and all the animals would become tame. And he really meant this as sort of an ideal prediction of the future. But it always sounded like hell to me. It was like, you know, the poor walruses swimming around in this lemonade and just the whole thing. And so I always liked
No. If you ever get walrus in your lemonade, it's really nasty.
For sure. Especially depending on the glass size. You know, so the, you know, I always thought that was great because it was meant to be his utopian. I think in a lot of ways he's a great utopian thinker. But exactly when he got most utopian, it sounded most dystopian. Mm. So I'd say that was one of my favorite dystopias because it's the most that's supposed to be an ideal. Mm. And I think that sort of shows that a lot of times what you take to be your utopia is your dystopia. Mm. I mean, it's sort of like the, you know, the phrase, you know, you never know when your bad luck is good luck and your good luck is bad luck. You never know when your dystopia is a utopia and your utopia is a dystopia once they're pushed.
My favorite, the Millerites, they were very good.
What was their vision?
Well, it wasn't so much that, you know, a lemonade ocean-filled world, but I don't know that lemonade was around in 1843, but William Miller, he predicted Jesus would come on, you know, 21st of March, 1843, and a lot of, you know, didn't happen, and then the event was called the Great Disappointment.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I love that there's an event called the Great Disappointment.
As opposed to the Minor Disappointment.
Yeah, which is like if, yeah, I mean, if, yeah, my mother would call that my life. Oh. You know? And then, and this was interesting, in Russia, the Russians are great for just, like, hysterical theology.
Mm-hmm.
In 1669, the old believers in Russia.
Right, three fingers, not two, I think that was the thing, the greeting.
Is that right?
That was one of the, yeah, they all went to Alaska, I forget, but I think, you know, in the old church, it was that you held three fingers up as the greeting, and the new church wanted two fingers for some reason, it was like...
And that's it, that's it, we're out of here?
Yeah, they were like, this is the kind of new belief that we cannot cotton with, and
crazy,
they just took off for Russia.
Crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, you're thinking it's like, so 1650. But 20,000 burned themselves to protect themselves from the Antichrist.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
so, and that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And then it was like, and that later that year was a fuel shortage.
I was going to say, that makes Jonestown look like a child's play. Well, I mean, the other one that Charles Fourier had that I always liked, when he basically said the end of the world was going to come because our desires had not yet been calibrated properly. We needed some new harmony of how we understood the relation of desire to the world. And he sort of said that, you know, basically if we could see other planets, we'd be able to see that they've been having the same problems, they've just worked them out better. And that basically with a good enough telescope, you can see people on other planets having much more fun than we're having. And that would be a spur to a new transformation and new development. Which I always just love just for the literalness of it.
People on other planets are having much more fun.
So that one.
That's great.
Yeah, and I always liked that because that was sort of that our world must end because we don't know how to mesh our desires and interests properly. And he thought that, you know, that would be our downfall of this era and that a new era would develop. But other worlds had eras that were further ahead of us.
Mm.
You know, and the utopian communes would have merged and formed some fantastic, you know, world. And that would be the key.
Mm.
Yep. Or as my friend John Martin always had posted wherever he went, party simply so that others may simply party, which I know is like a great summary, but that's sort of a good summary of Charles Fourier in some ways, I think.
Huh.
You know, just how would you manage your desires in the world so that things worked and that you were happy and other people were happy? And for Fourier, it would build symphonically.
Well, that's pretty
whereas, that, you know,
Christian,
at the moment we're
very,
sort of...
That's kind of an interesting take on... do unto others.
Yeah, although it's claiming, the party part is claiming you're also having fun. It's not merely negative.
But what, having fun how? Like, what is?
Well, I think, you know, like if you think of something like global climate change, you'd say, well, we're not partying others, you know, we're not partying simply, right? Because even, you know, living in houses of the form, you know, we would need to change so many things.
Oh.
That would be a challenge. Whereas I think the idea was, how would it be to actually be having fun, but with minimal impact. And
well, again, I hate to keep going back to the Irish and the people that I live with in the mountains up there.
Mm-hmm.
They knew how to have fun.
Yeah.
And really all you needed was, you know, a song and a fiddle or a squeeze box, good company, a rich culture, and lots of alcohol.
Right, right. Yeah. I've heard tell of that.
Yeah,
that was the trick for them.
But a canon of music and dance.
Yeah,
and that sort of spontaneous collaboration that unfortunately takes place only after lots and lots of alcohol.
Yeah, and seems to only really work in places where there's a tremendous amount of harsh reality around which you sort of crystallize that.
Yeah, no, true. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, yeah, to not have that harsh reality, you know, I don't know, is the amount of fun
party
related?
Simply so that others may simply party. Yeah, that's what I'd say. I think that's the ideal.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good note to leave off on.
Okay. That's my solution to the
Everything.
Apocalypse, yeah.
Let's party simply.
So that others may simply party.
Well, I'm not Thoreau. Well, I felt I had to go. I had to go. I'm not from history books. But I felt those dirty looks, dirty looks. Fill up with regulars.